In 2018, the Kesar family from the Eastern Cape were in turmoil. Disputes regarding building that had taken place on the family homestead had resulted in court action and an explosion of rage by their middle son, 39-year-old Tobeni. Just 2 days later, in the early hours of the morning, neighbours saw flames coming from the Kesar homestead. By the time dawn broke, daylight revealed a devastating scene. Four people were dead, and police were asking serious questions of those left behind. This is True Crime South Africa. I'm Nicole Engelbrecht, and you're listening to episode 208, The Kesar Family Murders. True Crime South Africa is an independent podcast and relies on listener support to keep going. There are many ways you can support the podcast. You can check out all of them at truecrimesouthafrica.com. The most impactful way is by joining True Crime South Africa exclusives on Patreon or Paybrew or Apple subscriptions or YouTube memberships. Among other benefits, you'll get free access to online TCSA events, exclusive episodes, discounts on my audiobooks, and ad-free episodes. So you don't have to listen to me say this every week. Listen through to the end of the episode where I discuss more ways you can help support the podcast. Today's case is one of familicide. And considering how many of these cases I'm coming across in my research, I'm starting to wonder how rare they really are. This case does also involve the death of a child, so please be advised of that. In researching this case, I predominantly used the judgments and sentencing documents from the trial, as well as one or two media articles. I was unfortunately unable to find any photographs of the victims. So let's get into episode 208, The Kesar Family Murders.
The following episode may contain sensitive material, including descriptions of violence, sexual assault, or graphic descriptions of injuries to victims. If you feel you may be triggered by such material, please consider this before accessing our content. To access trauma counseling or services, please see the helpline information in our show notes.
Mkondisi and Tubakazi Kesa married in their early 20s and welcomed three children into the world. Their oldest son, Ntembeko, then their second son, Tobeni, and finally their youngest child, a daughter called Nobubela. The family lived on their homestead in Tienbank in Sterkspruit in the Eastern Cape from when the children were young. Mkondisi and Tubakazi worked hard to provide for their family and to ensure that they would always have a roof over their heads. The family was far from wealthy, but certainly worked and saved enough to live a relatively middle-class life. As the children grew, they continued to stay close to home. Tobeni would have three children with three different women, but by his own account, he had never had a relationship with any of those children, nor had he contributed to their upkeep financially. All three Kesar's siblings continued to live with their parents as adults. In 2014, Nobubela gave birth to her first child, a daughter she named Hillary, and the child would remain living with her mother, uncles, and grandparents at the family homestead too. Over the years, the family had made do with the size of their home. They had a decent-sized piece of land, but the home itself was relatively small for the five of them. And then, as their grandchild joined the household, it became clear that they would have to put plans they'd had for a while to extend the house into action sooner rather than later. After much discussion, it was decided that because the two Kesar sons were unemployed and had a bit of building experience, they would carry out the extension work, and their parents would pay for the materials. There was never any discussion at this point about payments for the building work, because the men were getting the benefits of living in the homestead for free. They were unemployed, did not contribute financially to the home, and they would eventually inherit the homestead anyway. An agreement was reached, and Tsubeni and Ntembeko's parents gave their sons several thousand rand for materials they would need to build the extension. Work began on the building, and for the most part, everything seemed to be going to plan. It was near the beginning of 2018, though, when proverbial cracks began to show. With some of the building work done, the two Keza brothers had significantly slowed down with their rate of work, and it appeared the materials simply weren't arriving at the homestead. After much back and forth, Mkonyisi and Tsubakazi discovered that their sons appeared to have squandered a large portion of the money they'd given them for building materials. The two men, for their part, began to talk about how the work was hard, and they thought that they should be paid for their work. The dispute soon became heated, and it appears that Mkondisi felt threatened enough by his sons that in the beginning of July 2018, he went to a local court to apply for a protection order. A temporary order was granted, and as a result, the two Khesa men had to leave the homestead. Rather than see their children out on the street, though, despite the dispute between them, Mkondisi and Tubakazi directed their sons to go to a small property they owned about 10 kilometres away. It was a property used by extended family on occasion, and at that time, no one was living in it, so it felt like the perfect solution to the family's current issue. Despite the separation by distance, the Keza family disputes did not simmer down. And while we don't know exactly what happened to make their parents so afraid of their two sons, Mkondisi confirmed that he would be requesting that the court make the protection order permanent in the hearing for that purpose, which was scheduled on the 27th of July. Before that could happen, though, Tsubeni had instituted court proceedings of his own. Although, bizarrely, he would later deny this, despite there being documentary evidence of this claim. Tsubeni had opened a claim against his parents at the small claims court for money he said he and his brother were owed for the building work they'd done at the Khesa homestead. He was claiming the sum of 20,000 rand. On the 20th of July, the Khesa family attended a small claims court hearing to deal with the issue of the money the brothers claimed they were owed. The court official who dealt with the matter would later testify that the proceedings had quickly degenerated into a shouting match, despite his best attempts to keep it civil. The parents were standing firm in that their sons had misspent the money they'd given them for building materials and had made little progress on the extension, while the sons were claiming that they had stopped working because they weren't being paid. Eventually, Tsubeni had sworn at his mother and called her an evil person and a witch. As the parties were leaving the office, the court official said he had heard Tsubeni say that his mother had better decide whether she was going to pay him or not, because if she didn't, she would see what would happen. Although the official had instructed the parties to go away, calm themselves and make decisions about their future representations to be heard at a future hearing, that would be the last time the official would see all of the parties alive and in the same room. William Khesa was the brother of Mkondisi. He lived not far from his brother's family homestead, and at 5 a.m. on the morning of the 22nd of July, he received a phone call from his brother's neighbour. William was told that his brother's home was on fire. The neighbour reported that they believed the fire had started around 2 a.m. that morning. It had been noticed shortly after, and they'd spent a while trying to put it out themselves, but it had quickly become clear that the fire was fully involved, and before long, the house was burned to the ground. William arrived at the homestead to find that the house he had known most of his life was almost completely destroyed. He was told that that no one had emerged from the house, and it was believed that all four residents had perished in the blaze. William was aware that his two nephews had not been living at the house anymore, so as soon as he arrived at the scene, he phoned Tobeni and told him that he and his brother needed to come out to the homestead immediately, as something terrible had happened. Police had around this time arrived on the scene as well, and forensic teams began to scour what was left of the home. William soon realized that his nephews had not arrived, and when he called again and got no answer, he decided to drive out to the house where they were staying and collect them. He did this and brought the two men back to the scene. Inside the home, police discovered the very badly burned remains of the four residents: Nobubela, her four-year-old daughter Hilary, Nkondisi, and Tubakazi. It did not appear that the victims had made any attempt to flee the fire, and the heat of the blaze had been so intense that their remains began to break apart when forensic pathology staff attempted to remove them. The forensics team worked in the house for the rest of the day, collected what they could in evidence, and took swabs to test for accelerants, as well as photographs for arson specialists to examine. They did hand over the scene quite quickly to the family, and although I did find that odd, in the end, it may have been for the best. Around 4 p.m. that afternoon, the family and the neighbours of the Kessa family began to attempt to clear the homestead of the charred rubble. According to William, neither Tobeni nor Ntombeko had wanted to play any part in the clean-up process, and he said they hadn't gone anywhere near the house. Tobeni would later claim that he'd been helping with the clean-up. What is not in question is that just a few minutes into the cleaning-up process, someone moved a burned piece of carpet and found what they believed was a pool of blood underneath. The blood had seemingly been protected from the blaze by the carpet, and soon other areas were spotted on the floor and the walls, which had also been protected from the blaze in certain ways, that showed what looked like blood. The police were called back to the scene. The investigating officer, Sergeant Mda, arrived back at the house and confirmed that the spots and pools did indeed look like blood. Forensic teams returned to sample this new evidence. At the same time, Mda spotted the Kessa brothers. Seemingly, in the chaos of the day earlier, the brothers had not been seen by police. But now, Mda began speaking with Tobeni. Mda would later admit that some of the family members at the scene had mentioned that the brothers had been in conflict with their parents when he spoke to them earlier, and this had of course raised his suspicions. While he was speaking with Tobeni, his eye was drawn to the drawstrings of the tracksuit top the man was wearing. On the string, Mda could see what he believed was blood. He asked Tobeni about it, and the young man claimed that they were old stains that he couldn't get out. But the IO requested that he remove the top and hand it in for testing. Then he told Tobeni that he wanted to search the house they were staying in. The man agreed, and the group headed out together to the property 10 kilometres away. The IO and accompanying officers asked the family and the two men to wait outside while they searched the house with consent. In the room when Tembeko said he was living, police found denim jeans with what looked like bloodstains at the bottom. These were seized as evidence. They found nothing of value in Tobeni's room, but they soon realised that the toilet was separate from the house, and so proceeded to search that area too. It was a pit or long drop style toilet, and the IO initially saw nothing of interest in his line of sight. But he also happened to have a look down into the pit, and there he saw an item of clothing. Using a long stick, he managed to retrieve the item and found that it was a grey pair of tracksuit pants. The material and colour matched the tracksuit top he had seized from Tobeni earlier. and at the bottom of those pants were patches of what appeared to be blood. The pants were bagged as evidence. With a verifiable possible motive and items of clothing belonging to the two Kesa brothers covered in what most certainly looked like blood, the IO placed the two brothers under arrest. From the outset, both Thobeni and Thembeko insisted that they were innocent. They continued to claim this throughout their trial as well. There were two things about the incident that made police certain that this was not an accident. The first was that not one of the four family members had attempted to flee the home. Often, victims of house fires will be found in bathrooms or near doors where they've attempted to escape the home, but have become overwhelmed with smoke. Of course, it wouldn't be impossible for one or two of them to have slept through the initial blaze and become overwhelmed by smoke in their sleep. But for that to happen with all four was suspicious. This led police to believe that the victims must have been somehow prevented from fleeing. And the greatest likelihood was that they were dead or gravely injured before the fire was set. And police did believe that this was an act of arson, because the ferocity of the fire and the speed at which it engulfed the entire structure, as well as the severe damage to the victims' bodies, meant that this fire was extremely hot and spread very quickly. Again, this is not the standard for house fires. And so, police believed an accelerant must have been used, and the perpetrator must have set the fire in several locations. One would hope that the autopsies could have provided some of these answers. Smoke in the lungs of the victims, for instance, could indicate they were still alive and breathing when the fire was started. Injuries to the bodies could indicate that they'd been attacked first, before the house was set alight. But as the forensic pathologist would later state at trial, the victims were quite literally 100% burned. Very little remained of their bodies, and there was nothing much that could be gleaned as evidence. One thing they did discover, which just made the incidents all the more tragic, was that Nobubela had been 14 weeks pregnant when she was killed. Almost miraculously, despite the severe burning of most of her body, a portion of the young woman's abdomen was still intact, and the pathologist found a deceased embryo in her womb. There was never any evidence led about whether accelerants had been detected anywhere in the house or on the victims themselves. But as you'll hear in a minute, I must say that I feel the forensics in this case were less than stellar. This case would take a relatively long time to come to court. But part of the reason why is that about 8 months after the brothers were arrested, Thobeni escaped from custody. Both brothers had been denied bail, primarily because they had no place of residence that they could put on record for the purposes of bail. And it emerged during the trial that Thobeni had actually been on the run for several weeks before members of the community he fled to had captured him and called police. I will say that, terrifyingly, I couldn't find a single media article announcing the man's escape. And I can't even imagine how scared the rest of the family members must have been while he was on the run. Especially when they discovered why he'd escaped. Thobeni later claimed that he'd had no choice but to escape because his legal representative was not assisting him with a matter relating to the estate of his deceased father. He claimed that he'd been made aware that his uncle was trying to sell his father's properties, and he wanted to confront his uncle about this and ask him why he was selling his inheritance. Now, we don't know whether his uncle really was doing that. Legally, it probably wouldn't be possible until the two brothers' trials had been completed, because if they were both acquitted of the crimes, they would be able to legally inherit from their father's estate. But if they were both found guilty, of course, they would not. Thobeni had apparently gone to his aunt's home to look for his uncle, but had not found him. His aunt had assumed that he'd been released on bail and that she'd just not been informed of that, so she didn't phone the police. But Thubeni remained in the area and was eventually taken back to jail to await trial. When the trial finally began in 2022, the state led all of the evidence they had against the brothers. The stains, which had appeared to be blood, were in fact confirmed to be blood, and the stains from Thubeni's tracksuit top were matched back to his mother. The blood on Thembeko's jeans was actually matched back to him. It was his own blood. So that wasn't evidence of anything. The blood on the tracksuit pants, however, was found to be from a male contributor, which did not belong to either Thubeni or Thembeko. Of course, there was a male victim, but a pretty sad failing of forensics gathering resulted in it not being possible to match that blood to Mkondisi. At autopsy, DNA samples were apparently taken from the four victims, and the bodies were released for burial. Blood was also taken from the two accused. And it turned out that when all of those samples were transferred to the lab for comparison against the physical evidence, somehow two of the samples were left behind. It appears that because all of the victims and the accused had the same surname, the individual responsible for moving the samples over believed that they had the four victims' DNA samples. But what they actually had was two of the victims and two of the accused. The other two victims' DNA, including Condisi's, disappeared. So there was no way to determine whether the male DNA on the tracksuit pants was indeed his. Now, I do know that there is a test that can determine whether the DNA on a sample is a close relative of another sample, so I'm pretty sure they could have compared one of the brothers to the unknown sample and at least determined to a reasonable degree of certainty that it was Mkondisi's. But it appeared that these errors only came to light near trial, so it was not done. It did already look suspicious that the tracksuit pants had blood on them from a male and were shoved down a pit toilet, and the prosecutor did bring a family member to confirm that they had seen Thubeni wearing those tracksuit pants, because he denied that they were even his. But of course, a conclusive DNA link would have been best. The prosecution called the court official who testified about the threats that had been made toward the victims by Thubeni, as well as other family members who confirmed that there were serious problems in the family. The two brothers, amazingly, denied that there had been any issues at all with their parents and claimed that everyone who said so was lying. The protection order said differently, though. And this was another part of the circumstantial evidence presented, that the murders had taken place just 2 days after that failed small claims court hearing, and 5 days before everyone had to appear in court to make the protection order permanent or cancel it entirely. This, the prosecution said, was no coincidence. By the time the prosecution closed their case, one thing had become abundantly clear. There was almost no real evidence against Thembeko. The lawyer representing both brothers brought a motion to have the charges against both vacated entirely once the prosecution had rested. The judge considered the evidence presented thus far and decided that there was certainly not a strong enough case for Thembeko to answer to, and he was acquitted of the charges against him and set free. Thubeni, however, remained charged, and the judge felt that there was still enough evidence against him to answer to. Thubeni had been the one to make the threats, and he was the only one with physical evidence tying him to the crime. Thubeni took the stand in his own defense and did something that not only made him look really bad, but was also really something his lawyer should have warned him against. In a trial, when a witness presents evidence that one side disagrees with, That side is required to challenge that evidence while the witness is giving that evidence, so that the witness can have the opportunity to respond. If you allow testimony to be entered into the record unchallenged, you are essentially accepting that that evidence is true and correct. What Tobeni did, though, was wait for all of the prosecution witnesses to testify without challenging certain parts of their evidence at all. But then when he took the stand, he attempted to enter new evidence through his own testimony to refute the witnesses' evidence. Of course, neither the judge nor the prosecution were having this. And when the judge eventually handed down his judgments, he said that it was clear to him that Tobeni was trying to tailor his evidence to bring witnesses into question. Much of the so-called evidence he gave in his testimony had never been mentioned in either his initial statements or at any other time, and the judge said it was clear that he was simply lying in an attempt to create sufficient doubt. But he had not achieved that goal. In January 2023, Tobeni Khesa was found guilty on 4 counts of murder and 1 count of arson. 1 month later, he was sentenced to 4 life terms, one for each of his family members' murders. He will be eligible for parole in 2048, when he is 64 years old. It's important to restate that from a legal perspective, Ntembeko has not been found guilty of the crimes he was accused of. The judge did say in his judgment, though, that he believed there was a very good chance he was involved in the murders. Although we will never truly know what these 4 members of the Khesa family faced in their last moments, it is very likely that they were either assaulted until unconscious or dead, or a bladed weapon of some kind was used to attack them. I can't imagine why no accelerant evidence was presented in court, as this would have been vital evidence of arson, and the accused's clothing could also have been tested for said accelerant, which would have been an additional physical link besides the DNA. There is, of course, a very strong motive evidence here, but the South African legal system does not rely on motive to prove the presence or absence of guilt. After all, which average human being would be able to understand and agree with so savagely murdering 4 people, including a completely innocent 4-year-old child, because you believed you were owed 20,000 rand. It takes a lot for most parents to admit that their children may be a threat to them, which is probably why it's actually pretty rare for any parent to take out a protection order against their adult child. But honestly, abuse from adult children toward parents should be taken much more seriously, and more parents should be encouraged to accept the possibility that they may be in danger. Nkondisi tried to do that, but unfortunately it was not enough to protect him from his own son. I doubt that this level of violence had ever even entered the man's mind when he had applied for that protection order. More likely, it was a way to create distance and stop the ongoing and stressful feud. As for whether true justice was really meted out in this case, I guess that depends what stance you take. One man is serving 4 life sentences for these crimes, but it's entirely possible, according to the judge, that another is out there living his life with absolutely no consequences for what he's done. As is so often the case in courts of law, it's not about what you know to be true, it's about what you can prove. Just from looking at the record of evidence presented in court, I do think that the Khesa family was let down by police in this case. I think that from the moment police arrived on the scene and heard about the family feud, they may have thought they had an open and shut case on their hands. And while a lot of really good police work was done, the devil always lies in the details. And it would be the small things that were done and not done that may have let one half of this killer crew quite literally get away with murder. Most importantly, regardless of who was wrong or right in the family feud, all four of these victims were let down by someone who they should have been able to trust. Not just let down, but horrifically betrayed in the most serious way. Nobubela Khesa, Hilary Khesa, Mkondisi Khesa, Tubakazi Khesa. Rest gently. For more victim-focused true crime content, please follow True Crime South Africa on the app you're using to listen right now. I also have another podcast you might like called I Lived Through This. Follow the podcast on social media platforms for updates on new episodes, my books, and events I attend across the country. If you'd like to support the podcast and grab some True Crime South Africa branded merch, head over to sacriminologist.co.za now. You can stock up on a wide range of true crime-themed merch, including tumblers, stickers, pens, mugs, and so much more. Use the code TCSA at checkout, and you'll get a site-wide discount of 10%. In case you don't know, I'm also a true crime author with 4 published books: Samurai Sword Murder, Sizzlers, Killer Stories, and Bare Bones, which is also published in Afrikaans as Klipkoot. All of your support for the podcast and the victims of crime in South Africa is greatly appreciated. I'll be back with another episode before you know it. Until then, thank you so much for your support, and I'll chat to you soon.